Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. Aside from being one of the best sports writers in the country, Vincent Hogan is also a ghostwriter who has worked with such legendary sports people as Paul McGrath and Henry Shefflin. He's the one publishers call on when they want someone to tell the star's story. He joins us at Banter at the Back Page in Dublin to talk about what's involved in telling someone else's story, the work it takes against the subject's head, and the changes in the sports writing game he's witnessed over the last few years. There was an interesting piece by Roy Greenslade the other day about this writer called Norman Giller. And you heard of Norman Giller?
No.
Norman Giller is an English sports writer. He's mostly a soccer writer. And he's ghostwritten books for about 100, like loads of people. Kevin Keegan, Tommy Doherty, Gordon Banks, Bobby Moore. He reckons he's ghostwritten 100 books. So that sounds like a pretty extreme to me, doesn't it? A way to spend your life.
Has he been mentioned in the books?
No, he hasn't.
Yeah, you see, it's interesting the way some publishers, and one of the books I've done, which is out at the moment, is the Henry Shefflin book, and Penguin take the attitude they don't want the ghost mentioned. So the only mention of me in the book is basically acknowledgements from Henry at the back of the book, where he's one line, thanks for your help. Whereas other publishers take the view that, well, if you're a relatively high-profile sports writer, it may help sell the book if your name is there. So it's just a peculiarity of it. I mean, I don't know if anyone saw the movie, The Ghostwriter. Ewan McGregor?
Yeah, The Ghost.
The Ghost. And one of the interesting quirks of that movie is that he doesn't have a name. And right through it, they never name him. They never give him a name. And I think it's very clever because a ghost is meant to be invisible. And most publishers want you to be invisible. So I'm astonished he's written that many books, but I'm not astonished that I've never heard of him, you know.
See, I hadn't heard of him either until I actually read this piece, and it just struck me that here is someone who was obviously making a living. We'll come back to how much money you make or not make from ghostwriting in a minute, but he's obviously making a living because he's been doing it for so long.
Well, I mean, he's obviously doing it very well, and publishers really are only interested in deadlines. And give us a word count at certain deadlines, and if you do it and the quality is good enough, that's all they're interested in.
Yeah.
It doesn't really extend beyond that, because the one thing you have to understand as a ghost is you're only as good as your subject, and you know, if you have an ego as a ghost, you're in real trouble, because it's not about you, and people will never buy the book because of you. They buy it because of the storytelling available from the subject, not from your skill. Your skill is there as a fundamental bottom line, but it's not why people are buying the book. They're buying the book because they want to hear the story of the person you're dealing with.
Okay. Let's park the the ghostwritten books for a second and go to the other thing that we see in the papers every day, which is the columns. You know, and it often strikes people as really strange that the people they see whose photographs up the top of the columns, the sports people, the athletes, the managers, don't actually write those columns, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that relationship, Vincent. Talk about when your editor inside says, okay, it's coming up to the Tour de France or it's coming up to the championship and we need a sports person. And they sign someone up to basically contribute a column for the season. And he says to you, okay, Vincent, you're going to shadow him, or whoever they got inside, whoever else that might get. What's your approach? I mean, is it a case of obviously when you're writing a book, you're going to spend a lot of time with the subject. But when it's someone who maybe he might have 2 minutes for you at the end of a match, or he might look upon you as an unnecessary burden he has to deal with every single match day. How do you deal with that?
It's one of those things where, yeah, a newspaper will sign him up because they feel his name is marketable, and the last thing they'll think about is who's actually going to technically write the column. One of the first things I did when I joined the Irish Independent way, way back in 1985, I'm that old, I was sent over to Manchester to meet Paul McGrath because they decided Paul was going to do a column for the Irish Independent. And I met Paul in a pub very close to Old Trafford. He was going to some supporters club gig that night, and I was in awe of this big star, but I had to actually have some kind of semblance of a relationship with him if I was going to be ringing him every week. And we drank a lot of beer together and we got on like a house on fire. And as superficial as that sounds, when I was ringing him then subsequently for was never more than a 15-minute commentary on, you know, the Friday before they'd play on the Saturday, at least I felt I had a semblance of a relationship with him, as superficial as it was. But it's almost impossible if you don't at least do that, the bare minimum of sit down with them and meet them face to face. Sometimes it's thrown at you. You've got to do a column with somebody that you've never met and you know nothing about. But that's the newspaper business now. They just will make a reflex reaction and just say, a column with that person will sell.
Do you ever come across someone like who you're basically ghosting a column for, who actually turns out to be a decent writer? I mean, I'll give you an example of someone, and I'm curious as to know whether his column is actually ghosted or whether it's some of his own work. It's Nicholas Roach. I mean, like during the Tour de France, I mean, his column is like it's great. It's absolutely it reads really well. There's colour, there's sweat, there's blood. You know, you see the human side of that horrific race. So I mean, like, is there someone in there helping him to embellish that, or is how much of his own work?
There's a guy called Jared Cromwell who writes that, who'd be a journalist who's very friendly with Nicholas. And I think the beauty of that column, and I agree totally with you, I think it's a brilliant column and it brings people into the Tour de France and other great cycling races. They both understand what the reader doesn't get with other media outlets and what the reader doesn't get from television. They both understand that the reader wants... What did you have for breakfast? Something as simple and as basic as that. Why did you have it for breakfast? Who did you share a room with? What was the vibe in the room last night? You know, it's gold dust, because they understand, both the ghost and Nicholas understand, that we don't want to know where you were with 50 Ks to go. We want to know where you were last night, what movie you were looking at, what you had for dinner. Did you get to see your girlfriend or whatever? And that's the beauty of a column, because what Nicholas is doing, he's not bringing into the bike race, he's bringing into the place where the bike race is going every single day. And that's the thing about a bike race, it's such a movable feast. It's going to a different town every day, and that town has got to come into the story. And that's what's brilliant. And but it's Jared Cromwell does that brilliantly for him.
It's fantastic, and it strikes me as kind of like, well, again, it's an example of great writing, and that's what it comes down to as well.
But great writing without affectation, really just understanding that you don't need big words for great writing. Something I've still learning myself. You just need to paint a picture, and sometimes the picture can be painted in very simple language. Just bring people to where you are. And that's the beauty of that column.
Yeah. Have you come across, like, I mean, like on the circuit, you write about everything. You write right across the board. Have you come across, like, I mean, sports people and athletes that you think would make good subjects, but haven't been tapped? Like, you know, is there a case that there's people out there? Like, I'll give an example. When Christy O'Connor did that book, The Club, I mean, it was a fantastic read. Like, but I was kind of wondering, like, was he someone that was in the background for a while? Are there other people like him that, like, they have been approached to write columns, but you reckon they should be?
It's very hard to say, Jim. I couldn't really answer that, because, you know, I've never felt that I've seen somebody like that who, Jesus, there's a depth to them and there's an understanding of what would be interesting. Unfortunately, we're very one-dimensional. When you're a sports writer, you do your own work, and if you're ghostwriting a column or two columns, you just do it. And I sometimes say to people, the awful thing about sports writing over a prolonged period of time is it almost takes the wow factor out of sport. It's an awful thing about it. But, I mean, if you take, for example, the Bosnia match last Monday night, which was a wonderful occasion, and Ireland qualifying for European Championship finals, it doesn't happen very often. But when you're a writer there, you're preoccupied with the story being established with about 20 minutes to go, because you've got to file your copy 20 minutes after the final whistle. And the way that thing is gone now is we don't just email copier that. We have to fit it into a shape on the page. We've got to put a heading that fits. got to put a subheading that fits. We might have to pull a pull quote that fits. And your copy has to fit. And all of that has got to go. So if you're doing a color piece, say, of 1,100 words on the Bosnia match last Monday night, and you have 20 minutes after the final whistle to deliver it, the whole wow aspect to it is gone. You're just trying to make sure you don't mess up. And it's like a... It's become a joyless experience, I have to say, and I'm saying that against myself, because you're just totally preoccupied with getting your copy through, getting everything fitting, and having it done in time.
And that obviously requires great speed as well, you know, which brings me to kind of a quote that Paul Kimmich had on Game On, when the two you were on recently, or maybe last year, and like he was saying, it took him 3 hours to write 64 words. So, I mean, I'm assuming you don't have any problem when it comes to that kind of speed.
Well, Paul is a Sunday journalist. So they work to different rules. And when you're a daily journalist, you can't afford to. I mean, you know, you just have to accept that you can't start polishing your intros. You just have to do it. And particularly in midweek soccer international, you don't have time to blink. You just, during the match, you're writing. And you're, you know, if the narrative changes, you change back. I mean, one of the worst experience I've ever had as a journalist, I think, was Ireland played a few years ago in San Marino. Now, San Marino would be officially probably the weakest international team in football. And it was one of, I think, Steve Staunton's early games. And we were leading 1-0, but we were playing rubbish. And then, just on the 90th minute, San Marino equalised. Now, you have no idea what this does to a journalist who's doing live copy, because it has gone from being a really sloppy, miserable win where we get the 3 points that we're expected to get to being the worst result in Irish soccer history. And you're just zapping stuff and you're just in a panic. And then 4 minutes into injury time, Stephen Ireland scores the winner. So it reverts to just being a sloppy win. And it is horrific. It is absolutely horrific. And you are like a basket case trying to rejig and redo. That I'm scarred for life by that game in San Marino.
Okay. So let's kind of move away then from like the joylessness of that particular thing. And this is going to be where you can kind of say you're completely wrong, Jim, because it's like, you know, when it comes to the books, is there a chance to have more time with the subject? Is there a chance to kind of like, I mean, spend more time working the story in? Like, is there a chance to kind of like build up that relationship? You talked earlier on there about like, I mean, like Paul McGrath, when you started working with him to do the column in the first place, that like, you know, you spend that time with him. So when you were phoning him in, he knew who you were. You weren't, in the words of kind of like, in the words of Steve Collins, when he was talking about like Paul Howard, after Paul Howard goes to his book, he was the guy with the Milky Bar kid glasses, you know? You had a relationship built up with him. So it's like, when it comes to writing a book then, it's like, do you enjoy that kind of getting to know someone? I mean, do you spend a lot of time getting to know people? Obviously, you don't go as far as kind of Paul Kimmich moving in with someone. But like, no. I mean, do you spend that time kind of like getting to know them? And is it valuable? Is it enjoyable?
It's valuable because we are getting so little access to players now in the media. So little access that's not totally sanitized. That's not just very formulaic. So when you're doing a book, you do get an insight into an awful lot that goes on. For example, I've always taken the view, if you're ghostwriting a book, I would tape hours and hours and hours, before I'd even contemplate writing a line. Because I try to get the voice of the subject into my head, and I try to get their sense of humor into my head. I try to get everything about them into my head before I even attempt to start writing. And it's a privilege, I suppose, that they take you under their wing, but in some cases it's a very kind of artificial privilege, because you're just there to write the book. And in a lot of cases, I suppose, the subjects aren't particularly bothered about whether the book is good, bad or indifferent, because they're being paid a lot of money just to produce a book, so the view is just produce it. The Paul McGrath one, which I suppose you know, unequivocally, it's the thing I'm proudest of in my professional life, was very different for me, because from that time when I went over to Manchester in 86 to develop some kind of relationship with him to write his column, we became friends. And Paul actually did a book in 1994, which was the real generic footballer story, you know, as quick as you could say, lasagna, Tony Cascarino had the ball in the Italian net, this type of thing, you know, and that was great. So I had nothing to do with that, but I was visiting Paul in the Rutland Centre when he was going through one of his bad periods, probably 95 from memory, and he had asked me about four times to write his book, and I knew there was a lot of black stuff there with the orphanages and attempts to take his own life, and I just didn't want to go there. I really didn't. I actually just wanted to visit him as a friend. I don't know if people here probably don't know Paul, but Paul is the most gentlemanly, kind figure you could ever meet, who has lived a life of chaos. And I remember one day in the Rutland, he was asking me again, look, will you do my book? And I actually eventually said, look, I will do it if you give me access all areas. If you just open up all these corridors. Because I knew I could sit down with Paul for 2,000 hours and ask him about everything and get very little back, because he wouldn't have clarity of recall. But I said, if you can give me access to all of these people in your life, professionally and personally, then I'll sit down with you when I have their versions of the story. And he did. And he was as good as gold. And he actually totally bought into the fact that this couldn't be just a kind of waffly piece of football nonsense. It had to be about his life, because that was the only thing that made sense of him doing another book. It had to be about his life. And what I uncovered astonished me. But all the time I was thinking, well, my God, this is very dark stuff, and this is very raw stuff. And I to this day, I have no idea what it is like when you are handed a piece of paper with your life almost up on an X-ray. This is what you've been through, and there's an awful lot of blackness there, and there's an awful lot of stuff that's not particularly flattering. And I always expected the darkest of stuff, that maybe when I'd give it to him, it would come back with a red marker through it. But the only thing he picked me up on was my spelling.
but the thing about that, though, was, like, Vincent, that by you doing this, in some ways, you reckon contributed to him, I suppose, contextualizing what he went through. That he
I do, and it's one of the things I'm most proud of. I mean, the book grossed millions. The book went off the radar in terms of what it sold, and I still think there's a wonderful movie to be made out of the book. But I remember at the very outset saying to Paul, "Paul, this is going to be very raw in places, but what I want you to understand is that in 20, 30, 40 years' time, when hopefully you're still alive and you're still going strong, that book will be on your shelf at home and you'll be proud of it. And more importantly, you'll still consider me a friend." And those were the two things that I said at the very outset. I hope that happens. And I'm really proud of that both of those things have happened. And he still says to this day that it's one of the things he's proudest of, that his honesty gained him incredible kudos. I mean, the book won every award going, which for me professionally was brilliant for my vanity. But at the end of the day, he considered it cathartic. There was an awful lot of stuff there. And his view was that once he did that book, there was nothing to start digging from under a stone. That he felt he'd been just totally honest with it, and everything was out there. And there was nothing more that, say, some tabloid could dig up and say, here's the latest on Paul McGrath. It was very cathartic for him. And, you know, he still has his bad days, but he's generally in a good place now, and I think he's very proud of the book.
You said there, like, I mean, the one of the things that you're proudest of is the fact that you're still friends with him.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a quote you said about, like, I mean, the interviews you do, that you like to be kind of, like, I mean, to be friendly with someone. You know, you've done four books to date. You've done Henry Shefflin currently, and you previously did Eddie O'Sullivan, Nicky English, and obviously Paul as well. So, like, you know, is it the case for you that when someone approaches you about a project that you have to be, it has to be a situation where you know you're going to get on with this person and you know you're actually going to like them because it, is it because you're going to spend so much time with them and also because you want to put the best spin forward on it?
No, I mean, one of my weaknesses as a journalist, I'd have to say, is that when I go to interview somebody, I really want them to like me. And I
think that's a weakness a lot of us journalists share, Vince, yeah. In fairness. I was thinking about that when I heard you say that, and I was thinking to myself, that I'm like that sometimes. You know, we're all like that, unless it's someone who's right bad bollocks. And then, you know, you just want to get the quotes. To
yeah, but I remember doing a radio interview about ghostwriting with Paul Kimmage, and Paul would be very much of the view that, no, I mean, they don't have to like you. You know, this is our job, and we have to keep digging. And I've a kind of... an approach to an interview that there's always one key question you want to ask, and I will spend 45 minutes circling and just trying to get trust before I ask it.
And that hasn't changed.
Like, no, it hasn't changed. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if you've got the interview that's going to really kind of hit the nail on the head. But I don't want to do it at the expense of someone thinking I've exploited them. You know, it's just... I suppose I do like people to like me, which is... Paul would consider that a weakness. I don't know. But to answer your question, the books I did, I mean, I would have known Paul. I would have known Nicky English very well. Nicky lived 10 minutes away from me in the house. It was very easy to do. We used to walk around Leopardstown Racecourse... just with the tape running, and that was a very easy book to do. With Eddie O'Sullivan, I didn't know Eddie at all. I'd interviewed him a couple of times. He was seen as a fairly autocratic figure as an Irish rugby coach. I remember saying to someone that once I had agreed to do his book, I was very surprised that he didn't want a rugby writer to do it. Maybe he was very pointed in that he didn't want a rugby writer to do it because the perception of him was of a very autocratic figure. I remember thinking, well, this is just a body of work I will do and we'll never speak again. And it's been the complete opposite. I mean, Eddie O'Sullivan, we just got on like a house on fire. And right in the business end of that book, Eddie was in Boulder, Colorado. And I was at home and I used to email him and he'd be back on the phone within half an hour. He was a joy to deal with because he has an encyclopedic memory of everything that he's gone through, which for a ghostwriter is wonderful. Mm. That you just get this clarity in every recall of every event.
Did you ever check up on it? Like, or do you take him at his word?
You have to check. But at some point you realize, my God, this guy is just crystal clear in everything. And that's the way Eddie was. And Eddie's become a great friend of mine. I was doing something with him in Cork last weekend, actually, and he's completely unlike what he was portrayed. And just a real down-to-earth, good sense of humour fella who just got the wrong side of the rugby media. Ireland won three Triple Crowns on his watch. We won a Grand Slam under Declan Kidney in 2009, but Triple Crowns might be very difficult to win from now on, and I think people might just appreciate in hindsight how good he was. And then the other one, Henry Shefflin, which is out now, and I wouldn't have known Henry well. I was asked to do the book, and you know, it's 4 years since I went down to meet his parents in Ballyhale, so it's dragged on a long time, and I'm glad it's
done. I bet you know him now. Or do you? I always get the feeling with him, of all the people you've interviewed, I mean, like, you know, as a Tipperary man, I know and admire Nicky. You know, I mean, Eddie O'Sullivan, like, I don't know about rugby, but I take you, people have said the book is, his book is, it puts across the side of him that isn't captured normally. Paul yeah. McGrath, we know about. But in the case of Henry Shefflin, I often get the feeling that we don't really know him.
Mm. Well, the trouble with something, if you're working on something for 4 years, the first thing is you know the manuscript off by heart. So you're nobody to judge the manuscript anymore. You don't know it because, you know, how do people react to it picking it up for the first time when you could actually recite it off by heart? You've no sense of judgment anymore. I've got a real sense from people that they're surprised at how open he is in it and how open he is about his insecurities, which would never have been entertained in any newspaper interviews he did, and particularly before the 2009 final against Tipperary, where he had a semi meltdown at home. You know, just the pressure and the tension of being King Henry is distinct from Henry Shefflin. I mean, it's kind of you're like a cartoon figure. You have to be this person that the media wants you to be. And he talks in the book about if he played an outstanding game, and I found this very interesting, was that put more pressure on him rather than took pressure off him, because he felt he had to live up to that the next day. And maybe that's what all brilliant sports people do, that they just tyrannize themselves with this, I need to do that again, I need to do that again. But Henry found that he was just trying to be King Henry, as distinct from Henry Shefflin, husband, father of four children, son, whatever, you know, and working in the bank. And this is the bizarre aspect, I suppose, to GA players, that they're these gigantic figures here in the media and everything, and they go to work on a Monday morning.
I mean, like, getting to know someone like him over the course of 4 years, what aspects of his life surprised you?
Well, that aspect particularly, the insecurity, because you couldn't see it, because you don't see it in Kilkenny generally, because they seem bomb-proof emotionally, psychologically, they just do what they do. But also, he was the epitome of almost machine-like efficiency. The guy who just did it year in, year out, and no one kind of entertained the idea that he would be insecure, that he would be worried about who he was or what he did. And I mean, the book tells about how he eventually met this Christian brother who got into his head and just seemed to understand Henry like nobody had understood him all his career. And this happened in his early 30s. I mean, you think this is probably the greatest hurler who ever lived. And in his early 30s, he comes upon somebody who for the first time actually gets him and actually understands what all of this is about. And rather than being a sycophant, because great sports people, let's be honest, they're surrounded by sycophants, people who tell them what they want to know, people who just humour them. And Henry would always say that he could go through his life feeling everybody was humouring him, saying what they thought he wanted to hear. This man, the first thing he said to Henry was, I remember Henry had come back from an injury and he'd played against Dublin in Portlaoise. Played okay. And this Christian brother said to him the first night together, he said, what marks out of 10 would you give yourself for the game against Dublin? Henry said, maybe 5 out of 10. And he just looked at him, he said, I'd have given you 3. Henry Shefflin had never been spoken to in his life, and he was 33 years old, like that, ever. And that's why he suddenly thought, I need to spend time with this man. I need to listen to what he's saying, because he's not feeding me this syrupy stuff that everyone imagines I want to get. And I thought, I think that's very interesting. And Henry describes that first session in Callan CBS, where this Christian brother, who's the last Christian brother in Ireland, the only Christian brother in Ireland who still teaches, and he's in a classroom, and as they do in the schools, all the chairs are up on the table, and there's this one table that there's no chairs on, and this Christian brother is working Henry's body, but he's really working his mind. He's a massage therapist, essentially, what he was doing, and that's essentially what Henry went for originally. But he was getting into his mind. And to this day, even though he's finished hurling with Kilkenny, Henry still wants to talk to this man, Damien Brennan, because he's just such a clever man and such an insightful man in that he understands people and the stresses and how they can impact on them.
Right. I mean, you mentioned earlier on with Paul McGrath that like one of the considerations you had was that you have to have access to these people. Did you talk to Brother Damien?
I did, yeah. Absolutely. And I was saying to Henry, for months, and Brother Damien is a very private man, and he really didn't want to be involved in the book at all. But because of the way Henry described him, I said, Henry, I've got to meet this man. I don't care whether he wants me to meet him or not. I have to meet him because I cannot explain what he's done unless I meet him. And there was a kind of a standoff for the good 6 months.
Six months.
Yeah, absolutely. And eventually, I got this news that, yeah, Brother Damien will meet you. So, yeah, I went down to Callan. I spent a morning with this man. And it was hugely helpful. because he just explained to me where he was coming from and the circumstances with which he met Henry, what it was all about. And it was only when I'd met him and just got a sense of where he's coming from that I felt I could write those chapters about what this man had done. And I've met him subsequently, and I know he doesn't welcome the publicity, but he was such a vital figure in Henry Shefflin's career for the last 2 or 3 years of his career. I had to meet him, Jim. I had to meet him because I could have just written some bullshit piece about someone I had no sense of. Had to have a sense of him, and I'm glad I did.
Okay. I mean, like, you know, I obviously, if you're looking into the important things in Henry Shefflin's life, Richie Hogan tweeted something like last September or something, and he said it was a sad day. Henry Shefflin had left the Kilkenny Players WhatsApp group. Mm. So you get access to the Kilkenny Players WhatsApp text by any chance?
No. That's private property, I think. No, I wouldn't get close to that. I think that's very much their own group, and they don't welcome anyone outside it.
Okay, we've been talking a bit up here about the books and the writing of the books. Let's talk a little bit about the business side of things. You know, that, like, I mean, when a publisher decides that they want to kind of a book by a sports star, you know, obviously they're going to get the sports star. I assume they get the sports star first, and then do they give the sports star an option of some writers, or will the sportsman have an idea in his or her head who they'd like to work with?
I think generally the sports star will have an idea. The publisher might have a very different idea, but it's usually the sports star will usually pick a journalist that they've had some interaction with before, and they feel, yeah, I can get on with that person. But sometimes the publisher will say, no, we actually think that this person will do a better book. And it's funny what I was saying earlier, that some publishers want the ghost to be invisible, but other publishers actually want to push the idea that the ghost is a well-known sports writer who might have credibility or whatever. So there's a bit of a conflict there in terms of different publishers and what they want.
I mean, I don't want to. I'm not asking you for, like, my exact figures, but I'm right in saying that the lion's share of the advance goes to the person whose name's biggest on the book.
And rightly so. Yeah. Rightly so. I mean, you know, without the story, you've nothing to write. And absolutely. I mean, I do think, you know, I've heard some horror stories of ghostwriters of very, very good books that have appeared in Ireland in the last few years. And it's astonishing how little the ghosts have been paid. It's a huge body of work to take on. And I think some of the younger journalists are inclined to do it because it's a nice thing to have on the CV that I ghostwrote so-and-so's book. But, you know, for the money that they were getting, it was just disgraceful.
I talked to one ghostwriter in the last couple of weeks about a book, but it was a great book they've done. And I was just thinking, I was saying, you do it again. They said, are you fucking joking me? Never again. So, I mean, do you get approached about a book every year? Like, you know, and like, are you tempted to, or like, are you very careful about like what you agree to do?
I'm a complete mercenary. I will... Yeah, you do.
I thought that was Michael Moynihan. I thought he was a mercenary in your...
Well, he's a bigger mercenary. you do. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I would say you'd probably get approached for 4 or 5 books a year. I will do one if it's commercially viable. I mean, that's what I will do. I mean, you know, it's not a kind of a... When you're a ghost, it can't be about kind of creative vanity or anything, because it's not your book. So to answer your question, I will do it if it's commercially viable. And that's why I'm saying I'm astonished at how little some people are paid to do books. I won't do it that way.
Okay, so, like, aside from publishers coming to you with ideas, have you ideas for books yourself? I mean, you're a well-traveled sports writer. You've written, like I said earlier on, right across the coast. Like, I mean, different sports. Are there books you'd like to do yourself that won't involve sitting down with someone for maybe 4 years?
I suppose you'd love to do a diary of your year. I mean, Tom Humphreys did it a few years ago and did it brilliantly. But the one thing about that is I think you have to, and I think the hardest thing to convey in writing is humour. And I have so much admiration for people who can write humour well. and convey humor well, because I can't. And I always think, if you were going to write a diary of your year as a sports writer, there's loads of funny stories you could tell, but can you tell them in a funny way? And that's the challenge. We don't live that exciting a life that if you don't have some funny and some humor in it, that it would engage a reader for, God knows, 365, 400 pages. I think the easy option for me is to be a ghost and to be that invisible person who just gets someone's voice out there. Because I think when you're working daily journalism, the actual sheer psychological effort of sitting down and starting from scratch on your book, where the storytelling has to be about you, it's a very different place to be going.
We were talking earlier on there, before we started, Vincent, about Billy Walsh, you know, and you guys said, there's definitely a book there. You know, are there other people like that, you know, that you've kind of come across in the last couple of years where you'd like to kind of go, okay, I'd like to ghost them?
Yeah, Billy's an obvious one. One of the most inspiring people I've met in Irish sport, one of the most humble people I've met in Irish sport, and now lost to Irish sport, which is a great shame. I think Billy would have a terrific story to tell. It would have to go before the legal people and be scrutinised very carefully, because some of the people he's been talking about are very litigious. There are people like Billy who are very, you know, underrated, I think, in their own country. And I think we've seen that with Billy Walsh, that the Americans have just taken this guy and said he could be our golden ticket. And he may well be. Whereas his Irish employers have more or less said, well, we can have 20 or 30 Billy Walsh's in the morning. Proof will be in the pudding. I think it'll take longer than the Rio Olympics to find that out. But we lost a very special person in Billy Walsh, and I hope he does do a book, because he has an extraordinary story to tell.
I mean, something that even the most casual reader of sports book will have noticed in the last couple of years is the fact that the quality of the books and the kind of like the gritty writing is coming to the fore. You know, the days are gone when someone could just kind of put, like, I mean, do a Nashley Cole and put out like a very, very bland book. They still exist, but like they're less and less. This is obviously, did you regard this as a good thing? It's like, I mean, or what books have come out in the last while that you actually admire yourself? Do you haven't put your own name to?
Well, you mentioned Nashley Cole. That book came out in 2006, and that was the same year Paul McGrath's book came out. And I almost think that was a watershed moment, because Ashley Cole's book was published basically on the basis that he was a professional footballer who earned a lot of money, and I'm not sure who the publisher was. They thought, this will sell. It didn't sell. It sold 3,000 copies. Major English publisher. They lost everything on it. And I think that was kind of a watershed, that people were just getting sick of this, that it was like Wayne Rooney signing up for 7 different books, you know, I mean, just treating the public with complete disdain. And that was the year that Paul's book was published, and Paul's book won every award, including the British Sports Autobiography of the Year award. And it was just like, you know, if you were asked beforehand, at the start of 2006, you know, which book would likely be a better commercial success in England, Ashley Cole, who was an English international, or Paul McGrath, who was, you know, a decade retired Irish international, you'd have said, well, probably Ashley Cole. No, it just, the story was there in one book, it wasn't there in another book. And I think ever since then there's a kind of an acceptance among publishers now that the name alone won't be enough, that they've got to have a story there, and that there's got to be more of an effort made in the story. And somebody was in here last night, John Leonard, who was sub-goalkeeper to Stephen Cluxton with the Dubs, and I've read his book. I understand he wrote it himself, and it's outstanding, because it's actually telling a story, and it's telling a story of a life that descended into chaos, and thankfully has come out of it. And, you know, maybe there's almost too many kind of things of what Paul did, of the alcoholism and you know, the self abuse, and maybe we're kind of reaching saturation point with that, because Tony Adams did Addicted, his famous book as well. But there is an understanding there now that you can't just bluff the reader, that you've got to give them something real and a story that's worth telling.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually think people will always gravitate to someone being very honest and being very truthful and kind of talking about the black places they went to. I mean, Michael Dygan's book from a couple of years ago is a case in point, you know. I mean, and it must have been very hard for him to write that book, you know. I really think people gravitate more and more towards that, you know. I got that feeling last night with John Leonard that, like, he's surprised at the response he's got to it, you know.
Yeah, there's a young journalist called Pat Nolan who wrote Michael Dygan's book, and it's I don't know, you know, if the readership here is a hurling readership, I doubt it.
Fisbert, not a
hurling stronghold. But Michael Dignan is a former Offaly player who now does a lot of media work with RTE. But his wife died very young from cancer. And it was just a horrific situation where they had two young sons, and they knew she was dying from 3 or 4 years out. And Pat Nolan writes the book with Michael, and it's just beautifully written. It's a really beautifully touching book about the last days and that, and then trying to reconcile that with the madness that we invest in sport, which we seem to think it's kind of Bill Shankly's, it's more important than life and death, when in fact it's not. It's not even close. And it's a wonderful book. But again, we're talking about ghosts. There's a guy, how many people know Pat Nolan wrote it? And he did a phenomenal job. He's a young Offaly journalist who would have written it with a great deal of passion.
It's an amazing book, and it's a book I read by accident because my father got it for Christmas one year, and he said, "This is amazing. Read this." And it's superb, and more people should read it because it's one of those books that goes beyond just sport, you know?
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Last couple of questions, Vincent. Thank you very much for your time as well. Really appreciate you coming in on Friday evening to us. Last couple of questions. You mentioned earlier on there, and John Leonard talked about it last night, about like the lawyers and litigation. When you hand your book over to your publisher, you know, like, is there much of it taken out for legal reasons? Do you get a legal report, and does the legal report make good reading?
It's funny you should ask that, because the book I'm probably most proud of is Paul McGrath's book, and there's a story about, you know, I took 4 months unpaid leave of absence from my job with The Independent when I was writing that book, because I knew I just had to focus completely on it. I'd spent a year researching it. And Random House, one of the big English publishers, sent me a contract where they basically wanted me to absorb every potential libel. And I think it was just a case of a big English publisher trying to bully a small Irish writer. And there was a real standoff anyway, and it got to the point where 3 weeks before the deadline for me sending them the book, I still hadn't signed a contract. And because I hadn't signed a contract, I hadn't given them the copy. And I was getting very bullying emails about how this was going to be a massively expensive failure and everything. And I look back on it as one of the loneliest periods of my life, actually, because I wasn't able to really run the book past anyone. And I kind of felt, you would go from one moment thinking, this is a world-class book, this is just astonishing what I've got here and what Paul has signed off on, to thinking, maybe it's not, you know, maybe I've lost the plot here. And I eventually got a contract that I agreed to sign, but only at the point where I was giving them the entire manuscript. And it was the most surreal experience of my life, because about 2 months later, I was in France with my wife and children, and I got a text from a colleague who said he just bought the book. And I'm thinking, my God, the book is out. And that he'd read it, and he'd read it in one sitting, and it was the greatest sports book he'd ever read. And I just got so emotional, because it was the first affirmation I'd got that, yeah, everything I'd invested in this was worthwhile. And then suddenly it just took off, and it was winning awards left, right and centre. But to answer your question, the legal side of it, Random House wanted me to absorb everything. And it was almost a trick they were trying to get away with. That he'll sign this because he doesn't understand how this works. And I just read it from start to finish, and I said, I'm not signing it. And I got these bullying emails, and it was surreal.
Well, was that the first time a publisher tried to get you to identify them from possible legal cases as a result of the book?
Yeah, I was astonished. I mean, it was, well, to be honest, it was only the second book I'd ever written. And the first one was with an Irish publisher. So I'd never encountered anything like this. It's the grace of God that I read the contract they were sending me. Because if anything did kick off, I would have been liable. Yeah. And it was just a very educational thing for me, because Eddie O'Sullivan's book was done with Random House as well, the same editor and everything, and I was a very different animal to deal with the second time around, because I understood what I was dealing with. And of course, 3 years later, they had had one of their greatest commercial successes with Paul, when they couldn't have possibly known what I was sitting on. So they paid me a little bit more respect 3 years later.
And like just a final question on the litigation side. I mean, was there anything kind of like taken out of the Henry Shefflin book for legal reasons?
No, nothing. Absolutely not. But look, maybe I'm beating my own drum here. I think I have a fair understanding of what's dodgy legally and what's not. And I wouldn't generally put something in that was borderline.
Okay, cool. Any questions from the audience to round things off?
Yep. We're surprised to have Brian O'Driscoll's autobiography and Polkemich.
Was I
surprised what happened with Brian O'Driscoll and Polkemich?
I was, because I'd spoken to Brian about a few months into the process, and Paul is a very... he's a very kind of... he digs a lot. And I mean, that's what makes him the journalist he is. And I met Brian at Heathrow Airport one day, and I asked him how he was getting on, and he said, yeah, it's going grand, but last time I saw him, he was following Amy around the kitchen. And that's the kind of way that Paul works. It's kind of very forensic, and he digs very deep. I wasn't sure that if taking that approach, that you could get the book out quickly enough. That was my own view of it. And I don't know if that was why it didn't work out between them, but I did feel that it was a massive investment for Penguin, not just in terms of an Irish market, but in terms of an international market. They had to get it out. And I'm not sure that with Paul's forensic approach to it, that it was going to work that way. I mean, someone like me, who's much more... I don't know what the word I would use, but I do understand the deadline, and I will work to that deadline, and I will meet the deadline even if I'm not hugely happy with what I've done. I think Paul, as a Sunday journalist, and I would always make the distinction between a Sunday journalist and a daily journalist, Paul would feel that, well, if I'm not happy with it, I'll put it off for a week, or if I'm not happy with it, I'll revisit that. And I think he says himself, the brilliant book he wrote about Matt Hampson, the quadriplegic rugby player, it took 4 years. And you can see why it did take 4 years when you read it. It's magnificent. You could not do that in the time frame. I mean, normal time frame for producing a book is maximum 6 months. You couldn't do that work in 6 months. And I would love to have seen the finished product if he stuck with Brian O'Driscoll, because I think it would have been really interesting. And one of the things O'Driscoll said was he was finding him very challenging, and that would have made the book very, very interesting. But I'll tell you this, given the time frame he had, I think Alan English did a brilliant job with what he did produce.
Yep. I just want to ask about the... you said earlier about not wanting to get your own voice into the book as much as the subject's voice. I was thinking about the first Roy Keane book. Both of the figures there, the ghost, well, not the ghost, but the co-author and the star are very public, but it's parts of it sounded maybe a bit more like Dunphy than Keane, did they?
Parts of which book?
Parts of the first Roy Keane book.
Yeah, I think it's a trap you fall into. And I do think if anyone reads the first Roy Keane book, it's like you're listening to him and Dunphy's voice in places. I think Dunphy, to be fair, was very honest about how... You do take a poetic license. I mean, I would think anyone who reads the Paul McGrath book, I'm very conscious particularly of a section in it where I describe him out in the Neuromore Hotel when they're on international duty, and that Paul isn't allowed to go out with the lads, because in those days they could go out and drink a few pints, and it wasn't a kind of frowned upon if it was 3 days to an international. And I describe, Jack decided to kind of to fill the boredom for Paul to bring him fishing, and this fishing around the estate in Euromore. And I take real poetic license in how I describe it, because Paul would talk about the other players coming down and hiding in the bushes and watching him and listening to Jack trying to tell him how to fly fish. And he could hear the giggling in the ditch and that. And I take huge poetic license with how I wrote that, which was the beauty I had with Paul being agreeable to that. Now, I don't know if people read that and thought that Paul wrote that and that was Paul's creative, you know, qualities coming through. It wasn't, but Paul liked it, the way it was described. And I think you're very constrained if you don't feel you have that freedom to just take a few liberties. And in Eamon Dunphy's case, it got him into trouble, obviously, you know. But I do understand how a ghostwriter wants to take liberties.
Do you think there's room for another Roy Keane book?
If I could write it.
It's one thing that struck me as you were talking earlier on there about, like, when Paul McGrath did the kind of, like, let's call it a cut and paste. There was a cut and paste Paul McGrath book before your one came out, you know. And I'm looking at kind of how many books has Alex Ferguson put his name to since in the last couple of years, and there just seems to be always a demand for it, you know. I mean, Roy Keane, I kind of wonder, is there still that demand there?
Absolutely. I mean, Ronan O'Gara did two books.
That's the Munster rugby thing, Vincent. That's a bizarre world.
I mean, if you asked me, is there an Irish sporting figure who I'd love to sit down with and actually grill over a prolonged period of time and just get into their heads, and I'd be the last fella he'd ask to do it, but I'd love to do Roy Keane. I don't think he's been done. I know Roddy Doyle did a book with him. I know Eamon did that book with him. I think there's a huge aspect to Roy's life that he hasn't opened up on, and
do you think that comes down to control? I often think about him. And in Roy Keane's case, often when I look at him, I don't know the man from Adam, but often, like, just looking at him and his behaviour and how he conducts himself in interviews, he just looks like a control freak.
I think a huge part of Roy Keane's persona is to actually live up to the caricature, and it's almost a tabloid caricature. I am this emotionless, ferocious person. When he's not. Obviously, he's not. I mean, he seems to be a really good father, good husband. You know, if he was as ferocious and almost borderline unstable as we in the media like to depict him, well, I don't think he'd still be married. I don't think he'd still be living at home. There's an awful lot more to Roy than we're allowed access. And it's funny watching him as assistant manager to Martin O'Neill. I think there's been a sense. I was watching him on Monday night, actually, when they embraced at the end of the match, and I thought Roy was very close to crying, which was extraordinary, because you're thinking, we just deal with this desperate Dan gunslinger, you know, glares at everyone, when in actual fact, he's been reinvented by his assistant's role with O'Neill. And, you know, there's talk now, will he stay in the job? Because suddenly maybe, you know, clubs who wouldn't have considered him 2 years ago after he was sacked by Ipswich, they're suddenly saying, well, he has something. And O'Neill has spoken, this guy has been sensational for us. And you see him, actually, the little bits of training that we're allowed to see, you see him just going around to individual players and just saying things. And whatever anyone thinks of Roy Keane, if you're a professional footballer and Roy Keane speaks in your ear, you're listening. You're listening. And if there's one book I'd love to write, if it was like with Paul, Access All Areas, that's the book.
Okay, that's it. Oh, one of
you. Sorry, name the Irish star that you'd like to, Roy Keane, the woman you'd like to ghostwrite a book for. But is there anyone internationally that has your dream to be as far as Roy Keane, is it? From an international context?
I would have chosen Keane. I would have loved to have done O'Driscoll's book. I've always found O'Driscoll really good to deal with, and I think it's a pity that his book ended up being produced in the circumstances it was done. Again, I say Alan English did a brilliant job in the circumstances he faced. I would love to do someone like Brian Mullins, who, I don't know if you're probably too young to remember Brian Mullins, the Dublin footballer, who very controversial midfielder. apart from that, I'd be more inclined to do someone international. You know, I mean, I wouldn't mind doing Harrington. I mean, I think you'd lead a few years off to get into Padraig Harrington's mind.
He certainly would.
You need
a couple of years to kind of just listen to him. He's a man you ask one question to, and an hour later he's finishing up.
But that's what makes him so interesting.
I think he talks a lot, and I often kind of find with garrulous sports people that there's a lot hidden in that as well.
Yeah, but his capacity for self-analysis is ridiculous. And his capacity for reconstructing his golf game is ridiculous, but he's a really interesting human fella at the back of it all. And I think there's a great book on Padraig Harrington. I hope someone does a great book on Padraig Harrington, because he's a really likable fella who people forget he's now competing against people 20 years younger than him, and he's still able to win as he did earlier this year. And to do that, and people imagine golf is an unathletic sport, that it doesn't matter whether you're 40 or 20 or whatever. It actually does, because the maintenance you have to do on your body, the work you have to do on your mind to stay competitive at that level, where these guys, like, I mean, I think I saw McIlroy driving the ball at the Scottish Open last year 420 yards. I mean, you'd need a bus to get that far. Like, I mean, it's just astonishing what the young people are doing. And someone like Harrington, who in the media we're kind of sarcastic towards him, because he's changing his shoes. He took to wearing glasses at one stage, and no one could figure out why he wore the glasses. And they wore them into the press conference. You're saying, what the hell is he wearing glasses into a press conference for? But that's the way he is. He's just so challenging himself all the time. I'd love to do a Harrington book.
What about non-Irish people? Is there any like non-Irish names that come to mind?
Well, I'm a Liverpool fan.
Oh, yeah.
And Stephen Gerrard has just done a book with Donald McRae, which was done in 6 weeks. And I'd love to do a book with him over 6 months. I think he's an interesting guy.
Cool. Okay. That's great. Vincent Hogan, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you.
Huge thanks to Vincent for joining us at Banter. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us. Recommend us on your favourite social media network. Leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store. And don't forget to subscribe. Check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter. And we'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.